You're listening to episode 46 of season 13 of Home Order for day 314 of 2019. 314, of course, is the first three digits of the famous number pi, and that there is absolutely no significance whatsoever on this episode. However, I'm going to move that since we are all, I'm assuming we're all agreed that Julian calendar is superior to Gregorian, so I think that we should move Pi Day to today, day 314 of the year, rather than to how we do it in the Gregorian calendar, being arbitrary third month, arbitrary 14th day of arbitrary third month. So that's just a proposal I'm putting out there, request for comments. We don't have to do it right away, but it's something we should probably move towards for next year. Okay, in this episode, we're going to talk about Util Linux. That is the Util Linux package, which we've been covering for the past, oh my gosh, it must be months by now. We're getting towards the end. We're in the S section now. And, I should say the S section of user bin. And, of course, that comes after a long list of user bin, a long list of S-bin, and then a long list of bin before that. But we are getting there. We're getting very, very close. So the first one that I want to talk about in alphabetical order is script. Script is a command to record, in a fashion, your terminal session. So if you type in script and then some name of an output file. So I'm going to put output.session. It sort of secretly launches a subshell. You don't really even realize you're in a subshell, but it launches it, and it tells you script has been started. File is output.session. Now if I just do an ls return, I get a list of all the current directories files in my current directory, and then I'm going to hit Control D for Delta. That puts an end to the script recording session. What happens? Well, if I do a cat output.session, it is just, actually I'm going to do a clear screen first because it can kind of trick you. You have a very messy terminal session. Doing the output of the script file might not stand out to you. So cat output.session with a clear terminal, and at the top of the screen it says script started on today, and then bash ls, and then the contents of my current directory, and then exit script done at the current timestamp, which was mere moments ago. So it outputs exactly what I saw in my terminal when I executed or during the time that the script was recording. Now, that's kind of handy, I guess, if you're particularly conscious that what you are doing right now needs to be recorded for posterity, whether that posterity is for yourself or for a tutorial that you're writing for someone else or whatever it might be. That does seem like a pretty useful little command. So for instance, if you're just a person at home and you're recording a script on your computer, then I can imagine it would not be of much use to someone else across the world, because it's entirely dependent on your environment. That said, if you set up an environment and told people, okay, this is what we're doing, we're making an example folder, and in the example folder we're going to touch this file, and in that file we're going to put this configuration, and so on, then that could be useful. So it's a controlled environment that people can replicate on their own machine, for instance. Or if you are a systems administrator and you're training an intern or someone who's coming into the department and you want to show them how you guys do something specific at this organization, whatever, then I can imagine that this would be pretty useful. It is basically a screenshot, though, right? It's what you've done in a terminal session, all in one file. And while that is useful and it could be handy to follow along, it's not really all that different than selecting everything in your terminal history and copying it and pasting it somewhere. Except that, of course, most terminals have a scrollback limit. So script will ignore that scrollback. You know, it doesn't have to deal with a scrollback because it starts recording from the time you start the script until the time that you hit Control D. So there's the benefit of just being able to record long sessions with lots of lines involved, which could be a problem if your scrollback is, let's say, 1,000 lines, which I think is fairly typical. I mean, you may have increased it to 5,000 lines, who knows? But if you're running a couple of commands that have very long outputs, you could exhaust that limit. Now, the scrollback, I should say, the scrollback function of a terminal is when you take that little scroll bar and you scroll up, that's scrolling back, and you will notice that has a limit to it. Some have a very long limit, some don't. It really kind of depends on what your settings are. So the other interesting feature of script is that you can record the exact timing of how you've done something. Now, I don't exactly know the purpose of this, but it's kind of a little built-in screencast feature of your terminal, at least to another terminal. So here's what you can do. You can do script and then dash dash timing equals, I'll do t.time, I don't know, and then I'll name the file that we're recording to as, output.session again. Since script has started, file is output.session, so I'll do an ls. Then maybe I'll do a cd into the doc directory of the source code thing. I'll do an ls again. Then I'll wait a couple of moments, and then I'll cd back out of it, and then I'll hit Control D. So I've recorded a session, and I've recorded timing output to a file called t.time. So now if I do script replay dash t for timing, or dash dash timing, and I'll give it t.time as my timing file, and then I'll put output.session as my sort of my input file, as it were. Actually, I'm going to clear my screen again, clear my terminal. Okay, it's clear now, so I'll hit return. And at first it looks like nothing's happening. It just gives me a prompt. And suddenly it starts typing an ls. And then a cd in the doc. Return. And then ls again. And then I think I waited a little while. And then cd space dot dot. And then the script is done. And you can tell that the script is done because there's a blank line before your next prompt. But it plays back in your terminal as if though you were doing it. Like if someone was looking over your shoulder and not looking at your hands, they would think that you were doing those actions. Now, understand, it is not playing back the commands. It is simply playing back the session for you. In other words, I could change directory here and then point the timing information to my old directory. And it will act as if though, it will lie to you. In other words, it'll say ls, and then the output of ls will be an ls of that old directory that I was sitting in at the time of the script. So this is not playing back like a shell script or it's not playing back your commands based on and actually executing those things. It is simply outputting the contents of whatever file you've put your script recording into. In my case, it's output.session, but by default, it's typesetting. It's just playing that back line by line, or rather chunk by chunk, in the timing increment that that it took you to do in real life. And if you look at, let me go back into the original directory so I don't have to keep giving full paths, but if you look at the timing file, it's timestamps that are taken the moment that you press a key. So it's recording the rhythm of what you're doing, and that's it. There are some fun things that you can do with script replay. You can, for instance, speed up the replay, displaying some number some divisor. So if you do, for instance, script replay --, divisor, for instance, 2, then we should be able to double the speed. And we can do divisor -3 to triple the speed, and so on. You get the idea. An interesting one, in addition to this, just kind of straight divisor for the timing, is the max delay number, which sets a maximum delay between transcript updates, which means that you could have done a bunch of commands at some, you know, sort of all at once, and then you could have paused for, let's say, 10 seconds. Well, 10 seconds in screen time is really, really long. It's like an eternity. So you could say, well, max delay of 2 seconds, and then anything over 2, you're setting a threshold. Anything over 2, any longer than 2 seconds, is overridden and reduced to 2. So that would speed up the transcript playback in terms of spacing, but not in terms of pacing. I like that, spacing instead of pacing. Okay, so that's script and script replay. I think that knocked out 2 of them. Yeah, I did. I just glided straight from one to the other. Okay, so the next one is set arch. And set arch is a little bit of a weird, this is a weird one for me. It specifically says, so man set arch, it specifically says that it changes the reported architecture in a new program environment and set personality flags. And what personality flags mean, I dislike terms that imply sort of emotion or feeling. I'll just end the sentence there. No, I won't. In computers, because it just doesn't make any sense. There's no such thing as a personality in an architecture. But anyway, so what it says it does is it currently only affects the output of uname-m. So if I do a set arch --32-bit --3GB and then do a uname -m, oh, forgot to set arch, so set arch i686 and then --32-bit --3GB and then uname -m, all as one command, then I get a uname -m value returned to me of i686, which, if I actually do a uname -m without any of that preamble, I get returned what I'm actually running, which is x86_64. Alright, so that's kind of cool. You might think that's kind of cool. But if I do a, for instance, set arch PPC64 uname -m, it tells me it's an unrecognized architecture. Okay, fair enough. So we've got success with this set arch i686-32-bit-3GB uname -m, getting some interesting output there. So now if I go to, for instance, a folder of source code, we'll just go to this GNU Hello application. I'm going to do a make clean. And then I'm going to do a set arch i686-32-bit-3GB. So the 32-bit is telling it, as you can probably imagine, to treat or to report the specs of the running kernel has 32 bits. And the dash dash 3GB specifies that processes should use a maximum of 3 gigabytes. There's a dash dash 4GB, but it's ignored, but it's still there for backward compatibility. Yeah, dash dash 32-bit, or just dash capital B, turns on adder underscore limit underscore 32-bit. Okay, so if we do that, and then we do a dot slash configure, and we wait for hello to configure. You might think that it's configuring its environment based on the value of setArch and the constraints that setArch has just supposedly imposed on the system. And then if I do a set, the same thing, set, well, so first of all, in my output of the configure, it clearly says checking if the linker user x 86 underscore 64 dash slackware dash Linux bin LD is GNU LD. Yes. Okay, great. It's obviously seeing the 64-bitedness of my system, at least in some way. So then I'm going to do set arch I 686 dash dash 32 bit dash dash 3GB, and then I'm going to do a make. And it does that. And then if I do a file of dot slash source slash hello, that's the thing that I just built, it returns, just as I would expect, ELF 64-bit LSB executable x86-64. The interpreter is listed as slash lib64ld-linux-x86-64. Now, if I do the thing that I would normally do when compiling 32-bit and go to my, source, slash etsy slash profile dot d 32dev dot sh. Now that's not something that everyone will necessarily find in their slash etsy slash profile d. It is a profile created by in part by Alien Bob and I think some guy named Fred. Hi Fred. I don't actually know Fred, I'm just greeting him in case he's by chance listening to this episode. It's a profile which sets environment variables to make Slackware 64 use 32-bit compatible applications and settings. And there's a bunch in there. It's a really good script to look at, actually, just to kind of see, well, okay, what is... Oh, Frederick. Frederick is the guy. In fact, it looks like he may have... It looks like he's the originator of this, Frederick Emmott. And he is the one of the guys, or maybe the guy, who was doing Slam 64, I think is what it was called, back before there was a Slackware 64 project. So this is the 32-bit compatibility script for that. And Alien Bob modified it in 2009, it looks like, and has been using it for his multi-lib build. So it's this is something that enables multi-arch on Slackware. It's an optional thing that you can get from Alien Bob. I'll put a link in the show notes. So now that I've sourced that, if I do it, well, first I'd better do a make clean, or else this will fail miserably. And then just do a dot slash configure. And once that's finished, well, actually, let's look at the output here. So it's configuring. Let's see if I can just catch that LD. You know what would be handy is an application to record the output of my terminal. That way I could review it later. Okay, so it still actually sees the linker as the one in this user x86-64. That's interesting to note. Okay, so then I'm going to do a make, and that doesn't take long, and then I'll do a file on source hello, and sure enough, it says ELF 32-bit LSB executable, dynamically linked, blah, blah, blah. So that's the way that I would normally compile a 32-bit application on Slackware, and it is... sort of, as far as I know, kind of the way that you have to do it elsewhere. So it seems that setArch, as it states pretty early on in its man page, to be fair, setArch currently only affects the output of uname.m, dash m. Supposedly, there are some applications out there that, in order to find out constraints of how they are going to run, essentially just kind of ask uname, what are my constraints? And setArch apparently will affect those applications. What those applications are, I'm not too sure. Why you would need that, I'm not too sure. Because presumably the application would have been compiled as a 32-bit application, and so it should just be running on your 64-bit CPU. So I'm not too sure. I've seen some things online as I was searching around to try to determine exactly what setArch actually affects, but I don't have anything to test it against. I don't have any way of sort of seeing the practical use case of this so that I can report on it. All I have is a successful spoof of a uname-m. That's it. So that one's a little bit of an interesting case. I don't know what the intended use for that one is. I would love to hear from you, dear listener, if you actually have a found this on the internet report on setArch. I mean, because I can look on the internet and do a search for, what is setArch used for, and I can report on the couple of forum posts that I see. Here's one on Ubuntu forum, and it reports that there's some kind of bug. Oh, it's infamous. It's not just some kind. It's an infamous Diablo 3 problem. And I don't know, since that's really the only, with 5 minutes of poking around, it's been more than 5 minutes probably, but that's the only report of setArch's use in real life that I could find. So maybe, I don't know, maybe it was literally developed for that. Crazier things have happened. But whether or not there are other use cases for it, I just don't know. I don't know what those would be. Certainly, it's not doing anything that I can see when compiling. So I don't know if, maybe it would be different. Maybe if I used setArch in my 32-bit environment, maybe that would have an effect on how GNU Hello ran or got compiled, at least. That very well could be. And I guess I could really dig in and find certainly about like the adder limit 3GB that would be recorded somewhere. So I could do that, but honestly I'm not going to, because it's just not, I don't think it's that vital. And 32-bit is, it's kind of on the way out, if we're honest. So I'm not gonna go too deep into that, because there's coffee to be had. So why don't you go get yourself a cup? I'll go get myself a cup. We'll meet back here for more Udo Linux. Hey everybody, this is Klaatu, and I'm here to give you an advertisement. No, I'm just kidding. Wouldn't that be crazy if I started doing advertisements on the show? Just started, hawking other people's wares for money. That would be a different show. No, actually, I just forgot that I was coming back from a coffee break, and I thought I was starting the show, so I was, hey everybody, this is Klaatu, and then I remembered mid-sentence. We've already been doing a show for like 20 minutes. This is just the coffee break, but I mean, that gives you evidence that I did actually go get coffee. These coffee breaks they're not a drill. This is real life. We go get coffee during these breaks. I do hope that you do, because if you don't, then you don't have coffee right now. So, let's see. The next one in Udo Linux, by my reckoning, is setSid. Let me just verify to make sure I haven't forgot something else. So actually, we're gonna get through all the S's today in user bin for util Linux. That's kind of exciting. So setsid creates a new session ID, is what the sid stands for. Let me just check that out. Man, setsid, run a program in a new session. Yeah, it doesn't really actually say explicitly that sid means session ID, but that's what I imagine it could be. I don't know, shell ID, maybe? I'm not sure. And anyway, I had an interesting idea for a demo, but it didn't work the way that I had hoped. I couldn't get things to crash the way that I had hoped they would sort of crumble and burn. So the best demo I could come up with is I'll launch a different terminal here. I'll do a setsid. Well, actually, I'm going to do a setsid -h for help. And yeah, -- wait is what I was looking for. So I'm going to do a setsid -- wait, and then I'll do a sleep 90. So that sort of holds up that terminal, which goes a little bit contrary to what you would think setsid would do. You'd think that it would create a new session and therefore not tie up your terminal. And certainly you could do that with just setsid without the -- wait. That would send that process to the background effectively and give you your prompt back. In this case, I want it to take over my terminal. So this is an URXVT terminal that I've launched it in. So I'm going to go back over to my other terminal, which right now is a console in KDE. And I'm going to do ps-tree clat2 pipe grep -C for context. And then we'll do three lines of context, so -C3. And then I'll just grep for RXVT. And this shows me, oh, because I did the -- wait, it's still in that session. Even that demo didn't work. So I'm going to do it instead, just a setsid sleep 90. Then I'm going to do the ps-tree command. And what this demonstrates is that I see that I have an URXVT terminal running bash, and that's that process. There's no sign of sleep there at all. So now if I do a ps-tree clat2 pipe grep c3 sleep, I see that sleep is its own process. It is branched off of nothing. It is just its own self-sustaining running process. Now if I do a pgrep for sleep, I get the PID of 23070. So I'm going to do a kill-923070, and that killed that process. PS3 clat2 grep c3 sleep returns nothing. That's not very fun to look at. You can do a setsid -- wait sleep 90 or sleep 12 or whatever amount of time you want to sleep for. I did 90 because I figured there would be no way that I would need all those 90 seconds. And then do a kill-9. Oh wait, I don't know what I'm killing yet. Pgrep sleep 23165. So then I'll do a kill-923165. And in my other terminal, it tells me setsid child 23165 did not exit normally. No such file or directory. And that's really about the extent of what I could successfully demonstrate there. There's really only one other option, which is set the controlling terminal to the current one, which I didn't play around with. And I gotta say, in terms of practicality, I don't really see setsid being that big of a deal in terms of it, how it's being used as a command. You may as well just do a sleep 90 ampersand, or if it's some process that you want to continue to interact with, you can do a screen and then launch the process within screen. So in terms of using this as a way to sort of divorce a process of its parent shell, I don't see I don't see many advantages to setsid. Now there may be some subtlety that I'm missing. I didn't see anything reported online that took me by surprise. So I'm not really thinking that setsid is all that useful. Okay, next one up is strings, and this is the last S util Linux package in user what are we in, user S bin or user bin or whatever, or otherwise. This is the last one within Udo Linux. User bin is where we are. So strings returns, it finds printable strings in a file. This is kind of interesting. If you've never played around with strings, it's kind of cool. Okay, so I don't know if you've ever tried to look at a binary file. You may have before. And if you don't know what a binary file is, it's just something that doesn't consist of a bunch of text. It's other information that the computer has to interpret in some fancy way. Text a computer can just dump into any device, right? A terminal, a serial output, whatever. A printer, sometimes a raw sort of line printer. Doesn't really require any interpretation as long as it's within that ASCII text set of letters and numbers and characters. Binary has extra information about something. So if you do a less on, for instance, let's see if there's anything in my photos directory. Yes, here's one, image_0140.jpg. If I do a less on that, it warns me, hey, this might be a binary file. See it anyway. I'll say yes. And there's a bunch of unprintable stuff that appears on my screen. Now that's kind of interesting. Sometimes you can scroll through that and see if you see any interesting metadata hanging out in plain text. The easier way to scrub through something like that is with strings, which filters out all the messy binary unprintable stuff that your terminal doesn't understand and just shows you the stuff that your terminal does understand. Now that doesn't necessarily mean that you'll be able to understand it. I mean, it could be plain, it could be printable characters that still have no meaning to whatever language you speak, certainly English for me. Strings, photos, image, 0140, JPEG, and sure enough, I get a whole, actually I'm gonna pipe that through less, I get a whole long list here of stuff that means nothing to me. Now, here's at the very top, here is some interesting information though. There's EXIF, so this is EXIF data that we're about to see, and there's QCOM-AA, so I'm guessing that this is a photograph that I took with the old Firefox OS phone, because if I remember correctly, that had some kind of, I don't know, Qualcomm camera or something like that, I don't know, or a Qualcomm chipset or something. It was taken in 2015, 0702 at 1944. And so on. So it's got some EXIF data that you can actually read as plain text. So right there, that's kind of interesting. Now, after that, there are hundreds and hundreds of lines of just of nonsense. 4WWRXI7HFE, and so on. But you can kind of scrub through there and see if there's anything that's recognizable to your brain as something that makes sense. And sometimes there are. For instance, if I do a string there's a user guide in my docs directory. And if I do strings on that file, once again, it's a bunch of stuff that makes absolutely no sense to me. But I remember as I was scrolling through here, there were some lines of English. For instance, here it says, it was color space, yeah, bits per component 8, color space 17238. Now that doesn't actually mean anything to me personally, but I imagine that could be useful in some context if you were analyzing, I don't know, what color space something it had been embedded with or something like that. I'm not even sure what it's referring to be honest. We can do a strings on an OGG file. Here's actually, I don't have an OGG file because I have lots of OGG files, but the place that I just now looked is a commercial album that I purchased from some location, and it's an MP3. And interestingly, that's very interesting actually. So it's a commercial MP3 that I purchased. I did not rip this myself, so it was a digital purchase. And at the bottom of the file, there's a bunch of, there's lame 3.92, lame 3.92 tag, the author name, or the artist name, and the year. So that's kind of interesting that they apparently used lame 392 to rip that from their from their source. You don't always see that, actually, in commercial releases. That's interesting. So anyway, there's a bunch of little uses like that for strings. You could even do it on a something in your user bin or in bin or whatever you have access to really. I'll do user bin because we just have been talking about stuff in there. So I'm gonna do strings on user bin script. And it says that there's been, oh yeah, that is interesting. Wow, you should do, yeah, you should do that. That I should have led with that. There's a bunch of recognizable stuff in a binary executable. I think I kind of knew that deep down. I just kind of forgot because I don't really use it for that as often as I do to look at other people's media, really. Yeah, there's a bunch of recognizable things in here. There's some stuff about the whole the entire help message is here. That's kind of cool. There's a list of all the different options. So yeah, strings. It'll help you look into things that are otherwise unreadable and extract the readable stuff. Whether or not that's actually useful to you kind of depends on what you're looking to do. But it's, if nothing else, it's fun to do. It's an interesting way to introspect, something that normally you can't really get much of a window into. That's it. That's the S's from Evil Linux User Ben. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Podcast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually in channels such as Ogcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is @Klaatu, @mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, gnuworldorder.info and slackermedia.info. I will see you next time.
Charge.